Hello, welcome to Between the Covers. I'm your host, Bethany Grabo. Today's guest is author Amy P. Knight. Amy, welcome to Between the Covers.
Thanks.
Today we're talking about your book, Lost Almost, released in November 2017, that has been called an exploration of creation and destruction, passion and compulsion, brilliance and cruelty. Could you give us a summary of the book?
Sure. It follows the life of a physicist named Adam Brooks, and you get a series of incidents from his life and then some stories from people that interact with him in various ways, some very closely, immediate family members, and some people that only encounter him more tangentially. And through this series of stories and incidents, you get a picture of his life as a person and also as a scientist and how those things interact.
Well, before we get into the questions about the book, people may be surprised to find out that you're actually a civil rights and criminal defense attorney. So what makes you want to write a novel about a scientist working on the atomic bomb?
I've always been fascinated by science. I studied neuroscience and cognitive science as an undergraduate before I really got into creative writing as much. And I've been really intrigued by the types of people who become scientists and how that relates to their humanity. And I guess that's not terribly related to what I do in my day job, but lawyers do a lot of writing, and my professional life, I work on a lot of death penalty cases, and part of what you do in death penalty cases is tell the life story of the defendant to try to explain to a jury how they got to where they are and maybe convince them to spare his life. So there's a lot of storytelling involved in both things that I do.
I guess I didn't really think about it that way, that you're telling someone's story and not just the story of, you know, what happened and the crime and whether or not it happened, but just kind of giving the jury that background about the person. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's a sort of unique aspect of that particular type of law.
Well, the story, as you mentioned, revolves around renowned physicist Adam Brooks. So he's kind of revered by some and considered a tyrant by others. What are your feelings about Adam, and why did you write him in this way?
I am ambivalent about him. I think he certainly can be cruel, but I also have a lot of sympathy for him because I think he's under a lot of pressure in the work that he does in the book. And he's also not really allowed to talk about it. So, and that's something I can relate to in my work because there's a confidentiality aspect to legal work in addition to something like the science that he was doing with its national security implications. So to have the incredibly high stakes of his work and have to bear that basically alone, I could understand why he sometimes sort of snaps at people. I think not everything he does is admirable, but I think most of it, at least to me, is understandable.
He kind of had a more human quality to him. I was particularly interested in his relationship with his granddaughter, Katie. So it seemed like his interactions with her are the ones where we see him mostly as a sympathetic human rather than like this grumpy numbers guy who has impossible expectations of people. So I'm wondering, what is it about Katie that makes him open up?
I think they speak the same language in a way. So other family members, to varying degrees, are or are not math and science kind of people, but Katie is the same kind of math and science person that he is. So he's able to relate to her in his home territory in a way that is easier for him, I think. And he has a hard time seeing things from other people's points of view. And with her, he doesn't have to as much because she sees things very much the way that he does.
Now, there was a really interesting part of the story when she's a kid, she throws a rock at another kid's head. But she she's not thinking of it like, ooh, I want to hurt that kid. She's thinking of the physics of getting the perfect arc and hitting the target exactly where she expected it to. And nobody really understands, and everyone's kind of freaking out. But her grandfather, who she calls Adam, he saw that she wasn't trying to hurt the kid and just kind of got to the root of what happened. So I thought that was a neat thing that kind of humanized him.
Yeah, I think he might have done the same thing when he was a kid if he had been in that particular situation.
So did you have an Adam in your life?
I didn't. My father is a scientist, but he's not at all like Adam. He's much better with people and much better at balancing his work and his personal life. So Adam is pretty much just an invention. I do have a friend who grew up in Los Alamos, and some of the little vignettes come out of his life, but not the character himself. So, for instance, there's a scene in the book where Adam and his son are messing around with some sodium that they had, and it damages the ceiling in the house. And that actually happened to my friend, but the interpersonal conflict around that is invented.
Huh. I did kind of think of my own dad. My dad's an engineer, so he also is into math and science and things like that. None of us followed in his footsteps, but I could imagine him kind of having those expectations of, I want you to think the same way that I do and think very linear and in black and white, and this is why this works and this is how this works, and just like helping with homework and things like that.
Yeah.
He didn't have a whole lot of patience with, I don't know. Well, in some professions, you have a lot of responsibility. So doctors, for example, are making life and death decisions. I'm glad I don't have to do that in my line of work. In this story, we're talking about people making an atomic bomb. And in order to make and live with those types of decisions, I think a person must have to have some degree of arrogance. How does the responsibility of creating something that, if it succeeds, causes death, how does that weigh on Adam?
I think it weighs on him immensely. I originally got interested in specifically in atomic physics and the people doing that. I had read a book about a physicist named Freeman Dyson, and he was the author of the book. It was a memoir, and he talked about knowing physicists who, they really struggled with this, and there's this intellectual drive to solve the problem and figure out how to do it, but it's got these terrible consequences. And I think for somebody like Adam, he would focus on the intellectual part, and then the consequences would catch up with him in moments of insomnia, and he would realize what he was actually doing. You know, when you talk about a profession like a doctor where someone's life is in your hands, that's an intense pressure at times. And then if you think you've got the whole planet, the whole species, the whole everything riding on decisions that you're making, I can't imagine how that would really feel. I've tried to imagine it, obviously, and I think it could break anybody.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that affects his relationship with others?
I'm sure that it does. I mean, as you said, you have to have a certain kind of arrogance to do that. But at the same time, I don't think anybody is so arrogant that they would do that work and never have any thoughts about the impact of that and the true responsibility involved in it. So it catches up with him. And I think, you know, there's a scene where he's in his office at home having a phone conversation with somebody about something to do with this, and his son is eavesdropping. And when he realizes that his son is there, he just explodes. And I view that not as an actual legitimate concern about the eavesdropping, but more that he's just under so much pressure that this little thing is blown out of proportion.
Yeah, definitely. I thought it was interesting. I was doing some research, and I read this article and it talked about physicist Robert Oppenheimer, who is the father of the atomic bomb, and he was the director of the Manhattan Project. He later opposed the creation of a hydrogen bomb, and they kind of, you know, threw him out threw him out for his opinion. And he seemed to be worried not so much about the bombs that they dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but about a future of nuclear warfare. And I thought that was really interesting that he kind of, they theorize anyway, that he kind of felt okay about those bombs because they were a necessary evil. But when he's thinking about the future, like, my God, what have we created? And if it's unleashed, you know, it could be the end of the world. And kind of once we've opened that box, we can't close it again.
Absolutely. But I think people who worked on the hydrogen bomb and continue to work on weapons later in the evolution also at times had that feeling that it was a necessary evil, largely because of Russia, who was also developing these high-powered weapons. So it was sort of a, if we don't do it, they're going to do it, and then we're in even more danger kind of feeling, which is, I guess, a little different from the end of World War II situation that Oppenheimer was dealing with. But there are certainly ways to justify it to yourself, at least, I think, if you're mm-hmm. working in that area. And I think that's part of what the character and real scientists struggled with.
Yeah, just kind of, to do that type of work, I think you'd have to believe that what you were doing was important and a contribution to society. Otherwise, why are you doing it? But just kind of balancing your logical mind with your more emotional mind and just thinking, how is this going to be used and how will it affect people and will I feel responsible? You know, Robert Oppenheimer said, like, I feel like I have the blood on my hands for future use of this device. And the president was like, the blood is on my hands, don't worry about it, and then kind of threw him out. It was an interesting part of history that I didn't know anything about until.
Yeah, there's a great biography of Oppenheimer by Kai Bird and Martin Sherwin called American Prometheus. It won the Pulitzer a couple of years ago, and I read that early in the research for the book, and Oppenheimer was a fascinating person, and I certainly drew some on his worries in thinking about what it would feel like to be in Adam's position.
All right. Well, Adam's son and later his granddaughter follow in his footsteps, pursuing careers in science and a life in the lab. His grandson, however, has no interest in the subject and feels like an outcast from the family as a result. Many children follow in their parents' footsteps. Do you relate to either side of that?
Well, Not directly. I mentioned my dad is a scientist and my mother is a teacher. So there are no lawyers in my family and no fiction writers. But they've been very accepting of the things that I enjoy doing. My sister went into healthcare, and that's much more closely aligned with what my dad does. And in fact, my dad's parents were doctors, and they had a little name tag that said Dr. Knight that got passed down through the family. So my sister has it now. So she certainly did that more than I did. But I think as a family, we're pretty open to people's different skills and talents being used in different ways.
For those of you just tuning in, we're speaking today with author Amy Knight about her new book, Lost Almost. I think some of the characters, like his son, for example, tries to get away from Los Alamos and tries to kind of go in a different direction, and then he ends up being pulled back. Do you think it was the pressure of just, you know, pleasing his dad, or more just that's what he knew, so that's what he felt more comfortable with?
I think of him as a character who lacked the strength to break free from his father. I mean, Adam is a very powerful personality, and he seems to exert this pull over people even when he's not being good to them. And I imagine that it was really that personality that pulled his son back to Los Alamos you know, the son was on a track to do his work someplace else. And maybe, in fact, do it in a place where it might even be more appreciated. You know, Los Alamos, at least in its early days, was really a physics place. And even though they now have a big genome project and it's broader than it was, it still kind of has this idea of being a physics place, and a biologist is not the superstar there. But Curtis, the son, finds himself sucked back into that place where he's not the superstar because of his father's personality, I think. So I think he had managed to find himself a different place to be in terms of where he could be comfortable in his professional life, but as a personal matter, he just couldn't break free.
I think that must be a pretty common thing where I'm from. I know a lot of my classmates are still living in the same area and kind of doing the things that people do in that area. Mm-hmm. And I have no desire to go back and live in that place, but I think it's a pretty powerful thing to do things that are familiar and do what people expect. Well, this story spans genres. It has history, family dynamics, romance, science. The parts of the story that take place in the lab kind of and the lives of the people who work there make me think that you might be writing about something familiar. Is there anything in your background that helped you write about these subjects in such an intimate way?
Well, I worked in a neuroscience lab immediately after college, and I was considering going to graduate school in that field. And so I had some familiarity with what the life of science graduate students is like, enough to know that it wasn't something that I wanted to continue with. But most of my understanding of that stuff comes from reading. I read a lot about physics and physicists in writing this book.
What kind of research did you do to write the book?
I started with an Oppenheimer biography, but then what I really wanted to do was find some more contemporaneous sources, because I think it's hard when you're reading a history to get a sense of what it felt like at the time. So I found a number of things that were really helpful to me. The Los Alamos Historical Society had put together all these oral histories that they recorded that were available online. So you got people's reminiscences about living in the town of Los Alamos and to some extent about working there. Obviously, there are some limitations on what it's public, even now, about what went on there. But there were some really interesting things especially from the women who lived there, about the town and about the experience of moving there. So I drew on some of that. I also had the immense good fortune to just stumble upon somebody's collection of books about atomic weapons at an estate sale. So they were older books published in the 40s and 50s about the contemporary issue of nuclear weapons at that time. So that was how I was able to get a better perspective on what it actually felt like then, as opposed to what we see looking back at it from here, knowing where we are now.
Mm-hmm. Because Los Alamos was basically a town developed for the creation of the bomb, right?
That's right. There was almost nothing there prior to the lab being there. There was a boys' school, but there was no town there until the lab, and they created a town around it so that the scientists could have their families there with them. And you know, there was an elementary school. There were, and continue to this day to be, a lot of churches, which I think is fascinating.
Hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't expect that.
Yeah,
interesting. Well, I did find out that there's a Manhattan Project National Historical Park that opened in 2015, and their goal, according to the website, is to improve the understanding of the Manhattan Project and the legacy of the Manhattan Project through the interpretation of the historic resources. So I thought that was really interesting that there's like a national park.
Yeah, I didn't know that until after I had finished writing the book. And it didn't open until I was really finished mostly writing the book. But it was after I had it all put together that I learned about that. But I am really glad that that exists, and I'm excited to visit one day.
Yeah, that would be interesting, and maybe, picture your characters in these different buildings and things. It seems like a lot of the sites aren't accessible to the public yet, but they're working on it. But there are a lot of interesting pictures and stuff on the National Parks website, if anybody's interested in checking those out. I was thinking during this, reading this, my parents were children in the 1950s, and schools were doing nuclear fallout drills where they had to duck and cover. And it seems like the subject of nuclear weapons has kind of returned to the forefront of our minds recently. Did that affect your writing of the book at all?
It has. I mean, it affected revision more than it affected original writing, because it's really just been in the last couple of years. And the book, I had written most of it by the time we started really feeling that edges of that fear again. But it helped me to go back and read through it and think about that kind of urgency. And I also think knowing as much as I now know about nuclear weapons makes me more afraid these days with what we're hearing than I would have been if I hadn't done all of this research. So I have a keen understanding of exactly what we're looking at here that I wouldn't have had without all of this research. And so I don't know, that's maybe not such a blessing.
Yeah. We watched an American Experience episode about the Manhattan Project and all the testing of the bombs that they did. It was unbelievable. I had no idea the scope of how many things that they tested and just how it all looked. And to think of, elementary school kids, the sirens would go off and they'd like get underneath their desks and they were supposed to like cover their heads and faces. And I read a couple of things online, people were kind of just reminiscing about doing that and how even as, first graders, they were like, this is stupid. This is not going to protect us. So I'm just wondering, if we get to a point where they'll be doing drills like that at schools.
Maybe. I mean, maybe in Hawaii more than in the mainland U.S. when we look at where missiles can reach to. Obviously, there's a very different kind of safety drill that children are exposed to these days with active shooter drills. But I think that largely what they're being trained to do is a similar kind of fear for young children to have to train for some kind of crisis like that that's human inflicted versus something more natural disaster style. I mean, it's one thing to say, oh, we're going to have an earthquake drill, but there's this, how do you explain to an 8-year-old what they should be afraid of, whether it's a shooting situation or it's a nuclear war situation? I can't imagine. I mean, I don't have children myself, but I don't know if I did how I would be able to talk to them about something like that.
That would be really hard. And I also don't have kids, but I work with kids and they're always giving us articles and things about how to talk to kids about this. And I just, that would be a really hard thing. I had to do in my toddler story time, go over with the families really quickly what to do if there was an active shooter in the building. It kind of made me feel sick to have to think about that and to talk about that. So it's scary, but it's also, I guess, not a new thing that we're having to prepare kids for something that they don't really understand, but they know they have to be afraid of something, but they don't really understand what that thing is necessarily, but they have to know how to deal with it when it does come up. So
yeah, I think it's in some ways it's a very different threat and a different kind of fear, but in some ways it's the same. I mean, it's fear for your life and fear for your ability to have a future. And I think we had some decades where there was less of that, and now we're facing fears once again.
Yeah, we're out of the stranger danger generation, which was what I was a part of, and now we're on to other things. Well, we'll get back to the book. I've heard publishers can tend to be pretty ruthless with their editing. Was there anything that you wrote into the story that you were disappointed that your publisher edited out, or something you wish you could have added?
That's an interesting question. I for the most part, my editor was extremely helpful, and I think that pretty much everything she did made the book better. I did have a whole chapter that I had written that she ended up cutting, and I think it was the right decision in terms of the structure of the book and it all hanging together. It was the chapter about Adam's wife and a childhood friend of hers and their relationship later in life, and I still like it, and I still sort of wonder if maybe it can have a new life as a standalone short story or something. I might return to it sometime. I think the fact that I like that piece so much is probably why it was not something that occurred to me to remove from the book, and to have my editor's eyes on it and say, this doesn't quite fit in with the rest of what you've written. I never would have come to that conclusion on my own. So I'm glad she was there to do that for me.
You're not going to Stephen King it and come out with the long version later on when you become really famous. Well, what are you working on now? Should we expect anything in the future?
I'm working on a new book. It's not about science. I'll just say this. It involves a set of identical twins, which comes out of my life because my sister is my identical twin. And that's maybe the extent of the lived experience, because there are a lot of things that I'm writing that are not out of my own life. And I'm writing about boys. And so that's different from, obviously, from my twin experience. But I'm in the drafting phase of that, but I'm deep enough in that I think it's gonna go. So we'll see.
All right, stay tuned. You heard it here first. I appreciate you talking to me. Before we wrap things up, is there anything else you'd like to tell the listeners about your book, Lost Almost?
You know, there's a debate among readers and writers when you have a book that's structured this way, whether it's better thought of as a collection of linked stories or it's better thought of as a novel. And I've gone back and forth about that, and my publisher went back and forth about it. And I'm sort of always curious what people think about that divide. There are books structured basically like this out there that are labeled one way or the other. And I go back and forth between whether I think that matters or not. But I always have enjoyed reading books like that, because there's something fun about reading short stories and that they're sort of bite-sized, and you can get a full little arc inside of just 20 pages or so. But it's also, I also like reading novels because you can sort of sink in more and get a better sense of the world that these people are in. So I guess I hope that readers will enjoy what there is to be enjoyed about each genre in this book.
It does jump around in time, and it goes back to Adam's growing up and his early part of his career, and then it goes to his kid and his grandkids, and then they're thinking back to previous times as well. So, but I do like novels and that they have a conclusion. Seems right. Like a lot of short stories, you're like, but what happens next? So this kind of gives you the best of both worlds, I'd say.
That was my hope. Yes.
Well, Amy Knight, thank you so much for talking with me today on Between the Covers.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
Thank you for joining us today on Between the Covers. I'm your host, Bethany Grabo.